Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, the very deep story of Nelson Mandela. Our guest this hour writes, for his generation, South Africa had symbolized a modern moral fable. For millions of other people around the world, the mass global mobilization against the system of racial segregation known as apartheid had unfolded much like the international campaign to end slavery a century earlier. Douglas Foster is our guest this hour. He is the author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. It's considered the definitive work on post-Mandela South Africa. Douglas also knows a lot about pre-Mandela South Africa and Mandela's South Africa. He's the former editor of Mother Jones Magazine, former senior editor of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and director of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. He is now an associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. He, in 2004, crisscrossed the country of South Africa for more than 8 years and spent the year 2007 living in the country. South Africa really got a hold on him. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Douglas. We've seen so much television coverage of the memorials to Nelson Mandela, documentaries about him, and I'm delighted that we'll have a full hour to talk about this absolutely remarkable man and his dream and the wonders of the Constitution that have yet to be realized. The leadership following Mandela has had its share of problems. We'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, please leave messages there. We love to read them. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at KDunn Show. Douglas Foster, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's good to be with you again.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation. Yeah, a lot of the coverage, the documentaries I've seen, haven't spent a long period of time. Perhaps they assume that we know about the vicious system of apartheid. But I'd like for you to start this hour by talking about how vicious it was and how long-lasting it was.
Sure. I think it's a great question because you can't really assess Mandela's brilliance and his legacy without knowing what where he came from and the system he fought against. So apartheid, which comes into effect in 1948 after an election of the white electorate only in South Africa, instituted an extreme and peculiar form of racial segregation that determined everything about what a non-white would do within the borders of South Africa, including who they could have sex with or marry, where they would live. So the vast majority of the population was forced into 13% of the land in so-called homelands, Bantustans. It was a system I want to quickly point out that was partly borrowed from the United States. Some of the architects of apartheid visited the Jim Crow South in the 40s. And one way of thinking of it for Americans who weren't in South Africa during that period would be to think that the architects came to Alabama circa the 1940s and said, we can do that one better and we can institute on a national scale. The second thing to say, of course, about the effect of it in our context, we often see the South African struggle for freedom as kind of an extension of the civil rights movement in the United States because, of course, trade unions, students, and leaders of the civil rights movement here embraced that fight for liberation in South Africa. But the important thing to remember, of course, is that we're talking about a system that oppressed not a minority, not a racial minority, but the vast majority of the country. So those are a couple things that I would say about it. Apartheid instituted, kind of took all of the bad effects of hundreds of years of colonialism by the Dutch and the British, in which the majority was oppressed, and institutionalized it in a very detailed set of legal systems that produced a society where race and class were so tightly intertwined, and where social mobility up from the bottom was so tightly constrained for blacks and mixed-race people.
What a horrendous, horrendous system. You were in, I believe, South Africa in 1962. Your parents took you there. Do you remember that, or were you just a little guy?
I was in West Africa. So in the 60s, of course, word began to spread all over Africa, and maybe, who knows, planted as a youngster, I was only 5 or 6, news of this kind of fuzzy character called the Black Pimpernel. When Mandela went underground, he was well known, and there were stories about him evading capture by agents of the regime. And that's the context in which I first heard about him. And then the second wave of getting familiar with his image from abroad was being involved in the anti-war movement, civil rights movement, and women's movements in the U.S. You know, in almost any demonstration in the 70s that you went to, a protest or a teach-in, there would be posters of this figure as he appeared at his trial and sabotage charges of him in leopard skins, and that image of him went along on many, many, many demonstrations that weren't explicitly about South Africa. But I think he was seen as a part of a world challenge focused on racial and economic and national liberation.
Mm-hmm. It is remarkable, as you read about him and see documentaries about him, you think about the fact that every now and then, and it's not all that often, somebody comes along who's just the perfect person, the perfect temperament, the perfect mind to be able to accomplish something that's so revolutionary. And when I look at what Mandela was able to do as a prisoner, his thought process, his outrage about apartheid, his ability to be able to convince the very people who had been such horrendous oppressors that another way might be better, it is truly a measure of an extraordinary human being.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's also true that there was a generation of leaders in prison with him who were not so different, who came from out of terrible experiences of being jailed, of being threatened, of being tortured, of having horrendous things happen to their families if they were in the armed wing of the movement and in frontline states or in prison, who had a very clear vision of the goal, which was explicitly to create a different kind of society than the world had ever seen before at the southern tip of Africa. Very clear that society would be non-racial, non-sexist, anti-homophobic, and more egalitarian. And for that entire generation of leaders, the question was, how do we get from here to there? And lots of debate over whether that could be accomplished through violent overthrow or not. But I think the deep commitment and the kind of singular vision and the insistence on holding to that vision, even when it turned out to be much harder to achieve than they imagined, is really worth remembering on a day like this, too. So I think it's right to say here are the things that were distinctive about this one individual, but I almost hear his voice in my ear when I begin to talk that way. He would say, no, I was only I'm an ordinary man, which wasn't true, of course, but he would say, I want to remind you of the conditions I came out of, and he would repeatedly stop people if anybody was doing that kind of what he considered myth-making in his presence, and say, no, I came out of this rural background in which I learned this and that, and these other people were on the same wavelength. I came to the city and I was part of an emerging professional class that thought this and that, and that helped shape me. My ideas were sharpened in the underground, in the Mkontwe Sizwe. On Robben Island, it was the other comrades and I who developed these ideas. And I think sometimes that's presented as false humility, that he was just, not willing to accept the adulation. But I think there's a measure of it that's true, that he was shaped by, great leaders are shaped by great movements, and he was part of one, and saw himself as completely entrenched in part of a collective leadership in a movement.
Mm-hmm. You, I believe you were with your son at one point when you met him when he was an old man, and he thanked you for coming by to visit an old man. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. I've been thinking a lot about that in the last couple of days. It's the last time I saw him in person. It was after the World Cup in 2010, I was taking my son to see Indaba Mandela, one of the grandsons, who's one of the six young people who kind of threads the narrative of the book. And we were having lunch with him and his girlfriend. And as we took him back to the house, he lived with the old man. He said, "Don't you want to come in and see Grandpa?" to which the answer was not, Jake is already probably late for his flight. The answer was, are you kidding? Of
right,
course.
Right.
I mean, I'd been seeing him kind of across the passageway and in public events for years, but by the time I got to South Africa, he had decided he didn't want to sit for formal interviews or even informal ones. So we walked in, and it was so typical of him that he always began encounters by making a joke. So this was his joke. It's very nice to see that young people should still come to see an old man who has nothing new to say. And we all laughed. He laughed. And with him, that was always the beginning of a conversation. He would say something funny, but there was a needle in it,
mm-hmm,
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you can identify the needle, which is, I've been carrying this load for the last 70 years. Kind of, what have you done? embedded in it with a little bit of, I don't have anything new to say. I'm advocating the same thing, and are you coming to tell me that you've made some advance in in the struggle, all in this lighthearted way, but I think it was emblematic of the way he led, too. He could be very steely. There was a look I've seen him give that would make people shake in their shoes. He didn't become the great leader he became by being a pushover and only the fuzzy, warm, smiling grandfather.
Right.
He had a smile that lit up a room, and he had a kind of a discipline and clarity that drove people to want to be, as President Obama said yesterday, he made me want to be a better man.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly that was the effect of being in his presence, even briefly.
I find it so interesting, and you've done such valuable work here, that you describe yourself as the kind of journalist who goes to a place after some big event has happened to see people in their everyday lives, to see how that beautiful constitution is playing out, to see what South Africa is like after Nelson Mandela, other parts of the world that you've covered after some big change in government. We tend not to look at that, don't we? I mean, it'd be hard. We'd be hard-pressed to come up with the leadership of South Africa after Mandela. We find ourselves glorifying his time, Mandela the man, and failing to see how hard it has been to live up to that beautiful constitution.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, since I'm talking to another journalist, it's a problem of journalism, too. I mean, I am, as a journalist, I'm the kind of person who's sort of allergic to the pack. so if everybody else is, you know, I admit I had the pull to get on the plane, you know, be there for the memorial service, be there for the funeral. But part of the way I work is to think, oh, you know, I can see that streaming, and instead I'm booked to be there kind of from the middle of January to the middle of March.
Oh, you are?
Yeah, because I want to be there afterwards, but not when everybody else is there.
Uh-huh.
When it's a little bit clearer what the consequence of the passing is. And I think that, you know, to be honest, when I began going to South Africa in 2004, I went in the context of my work as a teacher of journalism at Northwestern University with students. My expectation, since I normally write for magazines, was that I would drop them off in South Africa because, you know, for major magazines, the story in South Africa was over. There was a miraculous, magical transformation under Mandela. There was a step back under Mbeki. His successor, Thabo Mbeki, was an AIDS denialist, and that was primarily the coverage that happened during that period. And then the current president is challenged on many fronts. But until the death, there wasn't the kind of expansive, comprehensive coverage of an experiment that you might expect. And that's understandable because, you know, two major wars have happened since then. The magazine editors I work with were most interested in getting me to some place of conflict, to write about ongoing conflict in the Congo, the border with Rwanda, something like that. And I think it is a challenge to we journalists because, you know, is it a story for us when the dogs of war don't bark?
Mm-hmm.
It ought to be. But I think it is a struggle for us with declining coverage of international news, declining numbers of international reporters to pay attention to that. Where are we being only driven by where the bomb went off, and where are we missing a story about a struggling but entrenched new democracy that has plenty of sorrow still and trouble, but also some really interesting turns that bring with it some seeds of hope?
Douglas Foster is our guest this hour. His book is After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Douglas, as you heard him say, took students to South Africa from Northwestern School of Journalism in 2004. He wound up living in Johannesburg for the whole year of 2007, and he's been crisscrossing the country for a number of years in writing this book. You can't talk about what's going on now without looking at the past, the apartheid system, the history of South Africa, the life of Nelson Mandela, and those who have succeeded him, the beauty of their constitution, and how hard it has been to live in a society that has that beautiful constitution with wonderful goals. What are the issues that have kept it from living up to that? We have the same thing here, right? We welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm sure some of you listening have been to South Africa and would like to share your impressions. I'm sure everybody who is listening has an impression of Nelson Mandela and the tributes that have been paid to him since his death last week. And we welcome your phone calls. Or I'm sure many of you have memories of the anti-apartheid movement in the United States, the divestiture movement, which was very successful at UW-Madison. Some of you may have been involved in that. Well, we'd like to hear from you, no matter what you'd like to say related to the topic. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. So that's how you can reach us, and please do. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls. We talk about Nelson Mandela, South Africa, during the time that he was president, what's happened since, the long struggle to democracy, all of that. And our guest is Douglas Foster. He is the author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Teresa in Tomahawk, our first caller for you. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Wow, it's just, thank you for taking my call. I was in South Africa in 2003 working in the beauty industry, and I was fully aware of what was going on, but I was surprised and appalled at the behaviors that were still seemed to be happening. I wasn't allowed ever to be alone, but one of my hosts, we came into a parking ramp area into their business, and he got out of the car, and he left his car door open, just left it there, expecting someone to shut the door for him. And I looked around like, who do you think is going to shut the door?
Right.
And I realized it was probably an African that he thought. So that's all. I'll take your comments off the air, but great subject. I've been also saddened by what has happened because I was able to experience South Africa as well. Thank you.
Teresa, before you get off, if you're still there, how old was this gentleman? I think we lost
Teresa.
Her maybe,
I'm sorry, she's gone.
But my sense of it, having spent now almost 10 years going around the country and interviewing individual young people and large groups, because my focus from the beginning was thinking that the liberation generation was getting a lot of attention and the half of the population, 25 and under, it's a very young society, wasn't getting enough attention. My sense is there's a real generational difference in that respect. Sure, there are still some spoiled white kids who expect their privileges to be entrenched forever based on the color of their skin, but smaller and smaller percentages. If you look at the polling, too, the recent polling, the likelihood that someone of whatever background or color is going to define themselves primarily first as South African without regard to race is going up and up. So that goal of stitching a national unity that's transracial, I think there are really good signs that that's taking place, and that, you know, based on that, an eventual disentangling of race and class, that that people, a white person won't get out of a car expecting that a black person will be following behind to clean up his mess.
Hmm. You tell us the experience. You started your book this way with the students that you were taking, driving along, I believe, the road to Cape Town from the airport. Students were
right.
Really struck by the poverty in South Africa.
Yeah. Well, right on the N1 as you come into Cape Town, and you can miss it if your car is going very fast, but luckily I had a group of very alert students. You know, you come across that kilometer after kilometer, mile after mile of townships, and this is partly historical. You know, that mixed race and black people were pushed out of cities, were constrained from being inside the cities. But part of it is a reflection of the fact that once freedom comes, people are free to move wherever they want to in the cities. And there's been a massive migration to the cities in the search for the better life for all that has not taken place in the rural areas. So you have even larger numbers of people concentrated in conditions of quite extreme poverty. So you can go in that 10 minutes from mile after mile of township to, of course, in the center of the town, past the Rolls-Royce dealership, and be on Long Street, a very popular and hip stretch downtown where it looks like and feels like Santa Barbara or Santa Cruz,
mm-hmm.
Ann Arbor in summertime. So that contrast is hits you in the face over and over again. I got a little irritated with myself at noticing it with such shock, because you know those those examples of entrenched poverty are not just country specific. They aren't just conditions that get laid properly at the door of the ANC government, although they belong there. But they also are a result of international trade rules and the rest, which leave very little room for developing countries to actually create the ladders of social mobility into middle-income status that people were promised and expect out of the liberation in 1994.
Let's go to Rand in Reno. Hi, Rand.
Hello.
Hi.
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the 70s down in Lesotho,
okay,
which is a small country surrounded by the Republic of South Africa. I was there when Madiba was in Robben Island, and I've got a little story that I'd like to share with you. I taught on a Roman Catholic mission, and periodically I would go the 30 kilometers over to the Republic of South Africa to buy things for the school. While in South Africa, I would generally go to the post office, and this was during apartheid, so there were two lines in all the public facilities, one for European and one for non-European. Well, I decided that I was non-European.
Right, right.
So I would get in that line and get up to the front of the line. They'd be very disgusted with me because, of course, the non-European line was for the blacks and the coloreds. That was kind of my little opportunity to kind of play with their system.
Mm.
And secondly, when I would return from South Africa and cross the river into Lesotho, I would feel a physical and emotional relief being in the free country of Lesotho and having left the oppression of the Republic of South Africa.
That's very, very powerful. You know, there's a small taste of that experience for visitors to the Apartheid Museum in Johannesburg, because when you walk into the museum, you're given randomly a black or white card. And based on being given that card, which is kind of a neat twist to remind us that the skin color we're born with is a twist of fate, a twist of birth, you take a different pathway into the museum. And when a friend told me about this, I thought, oh, that's really corny. That can't work. And the very first time I went with students, we were a multiracial group, some Asian Americans, African Americans, some Latinos in the bunch, and some whites. It was very, very and somewhat surprisingly powerful, even for that brief period. And so I'm not surprised that back then, when Mandela was still in prison, when the organizations were banned, and during a period when it was illegal to mention his name, to print his words, or to publish his photograph, that it should have that effect on you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Rand, for the call. Our phone number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. I'd like for you to talk about, because the book, of course, looks at the time since Mandela was president in large measure, although it has to cover everything. But I'm interested in how his successors and how Mandela, I know it affected his family personally, dealt with the issue of AIDS, which struck South Africa, all of Africa, pretty hard. It was interesting to look how different presidents handled this issue. You already mentioned one who was a denier, which is hard to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's an important part of the earlier question you asked before we went to the break, which is how come it's been so hard to get traction in reaching and achieving, fulfilling the promise that was made in 1994. And of course, part of the answer is that HIV/AIDS, this world historical force, walked in virtually on the same day with democracy, took an unexpected route, different from other parts of the globe, in which it became a generalized pandemic, largely spread through heterosexual sex, Mandela often said I'm still in this sort of fractured state where I don't quite feel comfortable referring to him in the past tense. But
right.
He often said that if he ends up in the other place, was the way he said it, as a proper and dignified gentleman, rather than heaven, it would be because of his failure to respond adequately and quickly enough to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. When he set up his foundations and in his post-presidential life, he did quite a lot. But I think that the reality was that they walked into office and believed that the economy might collapse. They, for understandable reasons, thought that they that there could be either coup attempts or an armed uprising by disgruntled whites. And in a way, the urgent squeezed out the important. I think that was part of it. The other part of it, Mandela said, had to do with the fact that it was a sexually transmissible disease,
mm-hmm.
that as a proper scent of the soil from the trans guy, people didn't talk openly about sex. It's some of the same issues we remember here. If you were around a major city in the first couple waves of the pandemic, in addition to the onus and the stigma related to men having sex with men, just the fact that it was sexually transmissible made it hard to discuss. So that's on Mandela. What's on his successor, President Thabo Mbeki, is that he believed, based on his consultations and his own research that relied on AIDS denialists in the U.S. And Europe, that a great scam was about to be perpetrated on South Africa, that symptoms caused by poverty were being classified as HIV symptoms, and that he thought on some level that a conspiracy was underway by pharmaceutical companies to medicalize problems rooted in poverty and then try to convince the South African government that their only way to deal with it was to consign a large part of the national budget to pharmaceuticals. He believed that there was a conspiracy underway by large pharmaceutical companies and the CIA to constrain the revolution, to medicalize it, to see South Africa's problems as, you know, all the old stereotypical tropes about black people, and he had this stubborn fixed opinion that was not shakable by other people around him who tried to talk him out of it, and as a result of that, the provision of antiretroviral medication in public health clinics were delayed for quite some time,
mm-hmm.
and hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives as a result of that big historical error.
Mm.
President Zuma's been much better on HIV/AIDS in spite of his own personal challenges in gender equality and the rest. He appointed a quite visionary minister of health, and as a result of that and a much quicker rollout of medication, the numbers of AIDS deaths have been going down. The rate of new infections seems to have plateaued. It may be, you're always hesitant to claim it, but it may be that a corner has been turned. That said, up to 1 in 6 South Africans are now HIV positive, and there will be many, many generations to pass before that proportion goes down.
Right. Here's an email, Sue in Sun Prairie. Can you comment on the rationale Western countries used not to get involved in the fight against apartheid? The Black independence movement, as she understands this, first came to Britain and the U.S. for assistance, but ultimately got help from Eastern Bloc countries and Cuba.
Sue's absolutely right that that the way in which the liberation movement ended up being dependent on Soviet support wasn't necessarily a choice. The South African Communist Party, of course, is part of the tripartite alliance that governs in South Africa. So there always was communist support for the National Liberation Movement. But these organizations, from the time they were banned and people went underground, were denounced in the U.S. by the U.S. government and the British government as terroristic. As the recent headlines have told us, Nelson Mandela himself remained on the terrorist watch list in the United States until 2008. So clerical error that also reveals this response that national liberation movements were inherently on the other side. So I think the short answer is Cold War politics led policymakers to see people as in our block, the free market, pro-capitalist, democratic West versus the communist bloc, and no shades of gray allowed.
Right. Our guest this hour, as we talk about Nelson Mandela and South Africa, post-Mandela, pre-Mandela, Douglas Foster is author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. He teaches journalism at Northwestern University. He's also been editor of Mother Jones magazine, senior editor at the Center for Investigative Reporting, and director of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. He spent a long time. He's been to South Africa many times, lived there for the year of 2007, has taken students there, and has crisscrossed the country and immersed himself in the politics and people and history of South Africa for many years now. More phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, feel free to leave messages there as well as the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour is South Africa. Douglas Foster, author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa, is our guest. Dennis in Manitowoc. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me on, and I'm really appreciating the topic. I want to just make a comment that when I came from a small town to go to Madison for my undergrad, the first movement that I really saw made me become politically alive, and that was the anti-apartheid movement. And students were building shanties on the Capitol grounds, and it was really very, very inspiring. And I got to thinking that that was about 27 years ago, and that was the time that Mandela had spent in prison and incarcerated. And I made a connection to what your guest was talking about, needling. You know, the comment of, you know, he was tempted to say, "What have you done lately?" And it just gave me a chance to reflect. You know, and the takeaway lesson is just the perseverance. How one man can stay true to his ideals for so long is just truly an inspiration. So, just a comment that it's taken me back a ways and is giving me many reasons to pause to think right now. So, thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
You know, it's interesting that he should say that, because as I've been going around the country talking about the book, the cities where lots of people turn out, and they turn out across the age range, but the people who are most riveted by it are people like the president, who, you know, for whom doing something in the anti-apartheid movement was a kind of political awakening that allowed them to make the connection between a struggle for freedom here and the fight for liberation there. And I think it is really, really significant. The president's speech yesterday was a powerful recognition of the same thing, that you know, half a century of the civil rights movement here, 20 years now of a liberation over there. It is an important moment to be thinking about those connections and maybe to revive that understanding that full liberation won't happen either place without the other.
Mm-hmm. And what about for you? You mentioned earlier that you're still having a hard time realizing that he is gone. Mm. But what do you, as somebody who's absorbed yourself, I mean, really got, as you said, a hold on you, the country, what goes through your mind and what do you think when you realize that he is gone?
Boy, it's just, you know, everybody has been so prepared, and I guess I styled myself as being more prepared than most because, you know, I'd been talking to members of the family. I knew that it was a bit of a miracle that he survived the most recent stay in hospital. So I thought I was ready, and I thought I had, I think I do have a good analysis about what it means, but certainly on an emotional level, that first reaction was like the feeling of being in a very strong wind, you know, just whoosh, really. And that's been the reaction I've been getting from friends in South Africa who style themselves as very hard-headed and maybe even very people who are very critical of Mandela. But just a kind of, wow, really, it finally happened. And part of it, you know, part of that shock and depth of emotional reaction is because he kept pulling a rabbit out of a hat, you know. The most recent illness, the ambulance that he's in, headed to the military hospital, breaks down
right.
for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Everybody thought, who I was talking to on that night, it was over. I mean, the members of the family said to me, come now. You know, there's going to be a funeral within, you know, 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And he fought back, you know, it's almost like, and I think everybody loved that, me included. I loved having, him kind of stick his thumb in our eye again and say, don't count me out. I think there was another piece of it that people, including me, emotionally responded to, the great, South African editor Ferial Haffagee said, you know, that Mandela has been preparing his people, quote, like a parent, like a good parent, unquote, for his trying to convince people of his dispensability, not his indispensability. And I guess I felt that, too, that, you know, he'd been so often saying in the last 10 years, it doesn't matter, I'm an ordinary man, I'm done, it's amazing you came to see me, even though I have nothing new to say. And then, you know, of course, when it's definite that he's moving, maybe not in your heart yet, but in your mind into the past tense, then you really have to begin to wrap your mind around what these 95 years meant. What he stood for, what he achieved, what he didn't achieve, and why, in a way that feels like a mammoth undertaking. You know, I think in a funny way, Ban Ki-moon captured it best yesterday when he said, a rainbow is the rain and the sun. It's completely mixed, right in the same word, of this deep emotional attachment. That is both, it's honoring him, actually, to have these contradictory reactions, which is, on the one hand, a celebratory and honoring, and on the other hand, a feeling of personal loss, even if you met him a very few times or never met him yourself, you know?
Well, then you have, and forgive me if this is too harsh or judgmental, but then you've got the presidency of Jacob Zuma, and, you know, he's got a lot of wives, he's got palaces, he's got charges of corruption, he was charged with rape. I mean, what are you left with?
Yeah, and I think that that's what was on display yesterday. He was booed by the crowd so loudly that they had to cue musicians to try to drown out the booing so it wouldn't be an utter humiliation. But you could see it in his face, this deep, unsettled feeling that he had lost the support of people. He brought his address up very close to his face and fumbled. through his speech. And I think that as the country goes into a national election, in a way, these ceremonies tee it up for a very serious discussion inside the party about the leaders that are put forward. And I think there will be pressure from the electorate, too. There is a very impressive generation of leaders, provincial leaders and the rest, coming up within the party who don't get very much ink, don't get broadcast coverage, don't get noticed by the outside press very much, who do have a capacity to reform the party from inside. And there are a lot of options in the opposition. I don't think anybody's predicting that the ANC would lose that election next year, but certainly the party is going to be given more of a run for its money, partly because, it's a bit of a twist since Mandela was such a dedicated member of the African National Congress. But this 10 days of mourning, celebration, and reminders of what he stood for, the creation of that new kind of society, comes to a kind of test in the election.
Yes. Yes, it does. We have time for maybe one more phone call, and let's have it be Dean in Appleton. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I'm going to go closer to the window so you can hear me. I've been to South Africa several times over the last 25 years, and I'm following the events as closely as I can, and I'm fairly satisfied with what's happening. Actually, I'm excited with what's happening, but there's a group of people that I think have not been, their status hasn't been really emphasized or even talked about, and that's the uneducated worker, the manual labor, which in the past, if you were white, you could get a job. And South Africans have always been hard workers, both white and black. But all of a sudden, that class of people do not have jobs. They're threatened, and you can imagine the stress level that they have. Now you can justify it by saying, well, in the past, you know, they had it so well. But I've stayed in the grooming houses filled with men. Well, not filled, but maybe five or six people mm-hmm. that I'm living with, and. You could see the stress all of a sudden they had, were unemployed or had mm-hmm. to, they just couldn't compete.
Douglas, address that in our short time left.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there have been a lot of stories, particularly about poor whites, poor Afrikaans-speaking whites, and I think their situation is a direct result of the collapse of all those big state industries that the former white regime had in place, and the larger challenge, you know, across racial lines, of course, is for the government of South Africa to have the room to create real manufacturing opportunities, which ultimately are the only real ladders up from the bottom and into middle income status. That are available. And many of those constraints against being able to do that are imposed by the international order.
Thank you, Dean, for the call. Douglas, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always good to be with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Douglas Foster, our guest this hour, his book is After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. We'll have him join us after his couple months in South Africa at the beginning of next year. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this program. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for on-air production here in Milwaukee. And thanks to Nelson Mandela for having lived pretty fully. Mm-hmm.